money. Money talks, money walks. Money isn't everything, but they say money makes the world go around. Money can't buy you love, but money matters because time is money. Money doesn't grow on trees, but it takes money to make money. There's easy money, even money, smart money, dumb money, old money, new money, mad money, funny money. There's loud money, hush money, short money, long money. You could be on the money, in the money, even made of money, because money makes the man. You can throw money at it, throw money around, even throw good money after bad. Money's no object when you're a money machine with money to burn, just pouring money down the drain. But for the love of money, I hope your money grubbing hands get their money's worth. Oh, more money, more problems. Got my mind on my money and my money on my mind. Get your money for nothing and your chicks for free. So show me the money. So that's three of the 16 scenes right there.
Hi, this is Craig Ballantyne, host of Early to Rise Radio. Have you ever wanted to become wealthier, healthier, wiser, or just have more time to appreciate the finer things in life? On this show, we reveal what high performers are doing every day to be more successful without sacrificing their personal lives. Early to Rise Radio is sponsored by the Perfect Day Formula. Get your free copy of this game-changing success guide at freeperfectdaybook.com. Now let's get started with today's show.
That was an absolutely epic intro from my friend Garrett Gunderson, the author of Killing Sacred Cows and the creator of WealthFactory.com. And Garrett is going around the country doing comedy on money, funny money. And also, he's doing two-day seminars on how to seriously grow your wealth. And that's what we're going to dive into in this episode of Early to Rise Radio. Garrett and I have been friends for years. And we start off talking about this comedy special that he recently did. And you're going to laugh a lot as we talk about money. But Garrett also has incredible passion about improving your wealth. You're going to love this episode of Early to Rise Radio. So, Gary, you made a long video on a comedy special and that you filmed in front of a live audience. Somehow you filmed that during COVID, it seems, in front of a live audience. And It's awesome. And it's almost all about money. How the heck did you come up with that? Like, what's your background that made you such an expert in money and the irrationalities and hilariousness around what we use and people obsess with in life?
So the name of the special is called The American Ream. Drop the D, and it's where people are getting sold the bill of goods that doesn't lead to happiness and all these financial things that create unnecessary risk. And I decided to film it on April 15th because in America, that's tax day. And it was during COVID. So what we did was we actually had to pay $75 per person to have them COVID tested. We had to set up tables with 6 feet distance, and people in the balcony had to wear masks because they just did rapid tests, where the people on the floor, they had more like these, the full on testing.
Yeah.
And so it was awesome, man, because I did two shows that night. It was awesome because I hadn't been around that many people for so long. The opening show, we started with my 13-year-old doing a five-minute set, which people went nuts about. They thought it was awesome. He was so confident. It went so good. I had been writing every type of phrase around money, every song title around money, and anything that I had thought was a name of money. And I had my co-writer, who's this comedian that was runner-up on Last Comic Standing, and my manager coming up with names for money as well. And originally, I just had it alphabetized, and I would put it on a teleprompter, and I'd do these Zooms to practice, and I would just say them as fast as I could. And people were like, oh my God, that's like George Carlin. That's Carlin-esque. And then one night, my co-writer had this dream about how to arrange it. So he took it and he made it into like a poem. And then he directed this 16 different shot video that's almost like a rap video around money that was originally like a dream that was going to happen at the comedy club I was going to do the special. And so we go from room to room, and then it was about me walking out of the green room at the end. And then I'm there live for the show that's being recorded. We ended up changing venues because of social distancing issues and camera angles and stuff. So the people that came to the show didn't see that money poem. What had happened is, and this makes me sound way cooler than I am, but I'm going to tell it how it happened. So my entire crew that helped me with this comedy special, I have these Emmy winners on there. One that won an Emmy with Chris Rock, one with Seinfeld. And the guy that won an Emmy with Seinfeld, I decided, hey, all these guys were underpaid supporting me because I'm it was a spec. There was no streaming service that was, you know, having this happen. So I decided to do a mastermind for them as like a bonus thing because they kind of invested in me. Mm-hmm. And they hadn't seen the money poem. My director had, but my executive producer had not. And one of my friends, you may know her. Her name's Cindy Crawford. She came to the mastermind that day, and she had seen the money poem because she couldn't make it to the filming. And so we're just sitting there in the mastermind at lunch. She turned to my executive producer, who had won MTV Music Awards with Aerosmith, and said, "What do you think about Garrett's like money poem?" He goes, "What money poem?" So I played it for him, and he goes, "This is amazing. We're going to start the show with it." So we started the show with it for the streaming pitch. And then it goes into all this thing around money, which I've been in financial services for 21 years now. So comedy for less time, money for a long time, but I'd written books about it. And now it's time to laugh at money's expense, as you said.
That's right. And I mean, money is this very confusing thing. So tell us a scary stat about money, and then we'll jump into, you know, how to fix our money and how you're actually taking this comedy tour across America to educate people about money.
So 95% of Americans are not financially independent at age 65, meaning if they stop working, they don't have enough cash flow to cover their basic expenses. 95%. So that's pretty insane. There was an article that came out a couple of years ago that said over 70% of Americans can't come up with $1,000 in 24 hours. Over 70% couldn't come up with $1,000 in 24 hours, meaning they don't have adequate savings, meaning they might earn money, but they're not really good at keeping money. And when we look at it, money's super intimidating. Like, there's a lot of people that are working hard and then they set their money aside, but then it doesn't work the way they thought. Because we're all in store for financial surprises. Everyone is. The problem is if we don't prepare for those surprises by having enough, you know, savings and liquidity, by having basic insurances that transfer risk, by not having basic estate or asset protection, because that sounds so intimidating and expensive, that we're one issue away from having our wealth confiscated in a way that's hard to recover from. And we've seen that because of things like a pandemic and COVID and quarantine be a problem for certain people. And that's why governments have said, well, we better start sending money out. Otherwise, people are going to be in major trouble. And people are in major trouble because they don't have financial intelligence. They don't have basic financial IQ, and they don't have basic financial structures. And we've been sold that we're too busy or it's too complicated. And, you know, you just got to do your best and hope it all works out. And the reality is our best has not worked out. And so I figured the only way to really get people to face it was through comedy. Because who wants to go listen to someone that is dry and boring and tells you you need to budget and cut back and eliminate the things you enjoy in life so that one day when maybe you're too old to finally enjoy it, you finally have the money to do what you love. So that's kind of how this was born.
Why the passion for money?
When I was a kid, my family really struggled with money. I mean, my great-grandfather left San Giovanni, which is in southern Italy, because he couldn't put food on the table. People say they can't put food on the table. He literally couldn't feed his pregnant wife. So he left with his half brother and his dad. They got on a ship, came to America, made it to Sunnyside, Utah, to hopefully become a coal miner in time for a coal mine disaster, became a goat herder, had to live in a tent, and finally got his wife and met his daughter when she was 7 years old. So over 7 years later, he finally gets them. Well, he had so much concern and scarcity around money, it plagued my family. They thought, hey, you got to hold on to what you got. You got to cut back. You got to eliminate. You never know when you're going to have a financial surprise. And so their way of handling it was to be in deep scarcity. Well, he was a coal miner. My grandfathers were coal miners, and my dad was a coal miner. And what happens in coal mining is you might have a union go on strike. You might have issues with coal prices. You might have mines shut down because it's no longer mining coal, or simply coal miners die because of those mine disasters. And so there were times where my family lived off saltine crackers. There were times where my family counted every single penny. And as a kid, I would overhear the conversations. I would feel the stress. I'd have my grandfather pick me up and feed me because my parents didn't have the kind of money to make it through. And my mom was working an extra job. And My dad's working side jobs just to make ends meet during those difficult times. So like when I started to actually get money is when I was 15 years old and I started a business. I was detailing cars. And then I won $500 for being third place at the Rural Young Entrepreneur of the Year competition for the students in free enterprise. And that was cool. Now I was a miser. I held on to those dollars. But the next year I won $5,000 for winning the state entrepreneurship for 18 and under. And at that $5,000, I wanted to invest it. My family was scared. They're like, oh, don't invest it. You could lose it. But I kept asking questions. And I went to people I knew that had more money than me, like my uncle who had a really nice house and was an executive for, you know, Utah Power and Light, and asked him. And then I went to a thing called Governor's Honors Academy. And I met kids that had wealthy families, you know, came from wealthy families. And I started asking their family who happened to be like CPAs. And I wanted to invest that money, but my mom wouldn't sign off as a custodian. So when I was 18, I got sold this notion that the stock market in the 1990s was always going to earn 18% a year. And so I took $70 a month and put it into something that in the year 2000 started to go down. And so I started to ask new questions. Now, ironically, when I was asking these questions in 1998, I got offered an internship. So I'm working for Park Avenue Securities and The Guardian selling life insurance and mutual funds. And all my family and friends thought I was a financial Einstein because, Craig, in 1999, everybody made money in the stock market. Everybody made money. They had a Wall Street Journal where they were having this thing where they'd take monkeys and teach them to throw darts at stock boards. And the monkeys were earning 30% sometimes because the market was just going up, right? And everybody was making good returns. And it wasn't until 2000 I really got super passionate about this because my family and friends that had put money with me started to lose. And I didn't want to tell them, you're in it for the long haul. Or high risk equals high return, because I didn't know why the market was going down, how long it would continue going down. And I decided at that moment, I was going to invest all the money that I had and that I had made from my car detailing business in learning about finance. So I traveled the country every single month. I spent somewhere between 2 days and a week flying places, using my young age to get to meet with really intelligent people. And I started to see that there were actually things guaranteed in finance. If you save tax, that's a guarantee. If you save on interest, that's a guarantee. If you save on non-performing fees or hidden commissions, that's a guarantee. If you save on duplicate coverages or improper structure with your insurance, these were guaranteed returns. And I was fascinated with efficiency. I was also fascinated with investing because I saw what the wealthy were doing because I got to watch family offices that work with people that they considered low tier, which was $30 million of net worth or more. And I started to see that they did things differently. They thought differently. And so I grew this passion for it because money is one of those things that when it's misunderstood becomes a block for people's lives. It becomes a burden in people's lives. It becomes a sacrifice where they give too much of who they are in hope for a better life. And even if they avoid the poverty that my family avoided, they get stuck in scarcity. And scarcity never allows for enjoyment or building a life we love. And so I started to really immersed myself in that. And I just got so fascinated. I was considered a fanatic because I was always with these memo pads asking questions and wanting to learn. And I made mistakes along the way. I got over leveraged in real estate. I invested in IPOs. I had a hard money lending fund. I thought investing was always going to go up. And then the year 2001 and 2002 happened. And then the year 2008 happened. And so what I realized was the reason why people are scared of money is because they've been burned. They've been hurt. They don't know how it works. And the reason they don't is because it feels complicated and people make money complicating things, unfortunately.
Yeah. Wow. That's amazing. It's so powerful. And so like money is not the root of all evil, right? Like people need to understand that, which is probably another reason that people are scared to understand it in some cases, whether it's a actual conscious block or a subconscious block. Would you say that is somewhat true?
And I have a joke in my special. It says, hey, people say money is the root of all evil. Is it? Or is it more about what people would do for it or because of it? And Craig, do you think Satan gets pissed when money gets the credit he feels he deserves? Just being like, probably, sitting in hell being like, that wasn't money, that was me, you know? And like, is there a number where we're totally safe, but if we earn one more dollar, we're screwed? I mean, if that's true, we're not going to have to worry about it. Other people have a head start. Like if Jeff Bezos turns in all of his drones for Terminators, then we'll know that it's evil, right? If all of a sudden you get a knock at the door and it's like, are these your socks? And it's a Terminator, you know, looking for Sarah Connor. I mean, it's evil when we put it above people or at the expense of ourselves. Yeah. In and of itself, it's a man-made efficient tool to exchange with one another. Money represents value and accounts for value created in the past, but it doesn't tell us what our potential is, and it doesn't dictate our destiny. So when we have it in its proper context or place as a byproduct of value creation, when money follows value and we become value creators, and we don't tie our value in our net worth or in our self-worth and our net worth is separated, we can actually start using money as a tool. And now, if we think money's unimportant, we're probably not going to have much of it, because who needs a bunch of unimportant stuff lying around? Or if we think money is evil, we might start to avoid it, but we avoid value of other people and creating value for those people if we vilify money. I'm here to help make money no longer like a blinder where people are chasing money at the expense of themselves, or taking it and holding on to it, or competing for it, and instead helping them discover who they are and then add more value, serve more people, solve bigger problems, and make money by doing that.
Man, that's so awesome. And I know you've built multiple businesses around this. You've helped so many people, so many of my friends, and you've written best-selling books and all of this stuff. But I want to go back to something where you said you won a $5,000 prize at age 18 for the entrepreneurship. What the heck did you do?
So I went and presented my car detailing business, and I won for my, you know, for presenting how that was. And when the $5,000 came in, I started interviewing the president of a credit union, because I used to, you know, detail the repossessed vehicles there. And he told me to put the money in a CD. And I went and talked to my uncle, and he told me to put my money in Novell stock, which Novell used to own like 87% of the internet. And now most people probably haven't heard of Novell. So that would have been a bad investment. But it was that process that led me towards learning about money. And I did invest part of that money, but mostly I invested it in learning about what to do. It paid for flights. It paid for workshops and symposiums. It paid for an education outside of college, because I was scholarships in college. So I actually went to a program called LEAP, which is kind of a life insurance selling program, but it's Lifetime Economic Acceleration Program. And it taught me about opportunity cost. It taught me about risk management. It taught me about cash flow. And then I started to immerse myself in books like Rich Dad Poor Dad and interviewing Robert Kiyosaki's advisors, who I'm still friends with to this day. And so I got my real education by losing some of my clients' money temporarily. But good news was I got them out by May of 2000, which the market went down in 2001 and 2002. So we saved hundreds of thousands of dollars. It would have been millions, but I didn't have that much under management. And then I really didn't want to feel that sickening feeling of going to people that were my family and saying, hey, you're in it for the long haul. And so that led to, you know, investing in myself, which led to a lot of these insights that I have and that I teach today.
You said you used your young age to get meetings with successful people. Most people would say, I'm too young, I'll never get a meeting with them. How did you turn your disadvantage into an advantage?
I learned when I was 15 and I did that first presentation, I met Steve and Cindy Gilbert, who were they did big donations to Southern Utah University, where I went to school. And when I went to Governor's Honors Academy, they also spoke there and they talked about how they like to invest in the youth and they like to pay it forward and they like curiosity in young people. And that if kids came to them, not just looking for a salary or an income, but were willing to do internships or take them to lunch, that they would help them out. So I put that in my head. And then when I would go to events, they always like to see the young kid at the event being like, holy cow, look at this. Like, I have a 25-year-old right now that is going to come to a 2-day immersion with me. Because he's already doing extraordinarily well in the financial business. He's already paid to come to my workshops. And I love that he's young. It makes me, and so I'm actually going to spend a little more time with him because I like paying it forward. I like to see other people do well. And I just feel like the younger you are, the more advantage you have, that you don't have to write a big check to have access to some of these people. And that's what I did.
Yeah, absolutely. I love that. Now, then you said, you know, you made some mistakes along the way. And the mistakes that you made were probably different than the average mistake that maybe our listeners are even still making. So what are the top money mistakes that you see And maybe you can categorize them as, you know, here's a beginner mistake. You know, when somebody's, you know, gets their first $20,000 or $50,000 in savings, here's a mistake when somebody, you know, even has enough money to buy a home, or when they have, you know, they get to a few hundred thousand dollars in the bank, like an entrepreneur. We probably have a lot of entrepreneurs listening that maybe have too much cash in the bank and don't know what to do, or even just with, you know, the whole mutual fund world is a tricky thing. You know, some people hate it, and a lot of people have a lot of money in it. And you can feel embarrassed when you hear an expert say, you know, you should never do that. But we just love to hear money mistakes across the board, and also preferably with a little bit of a tip on what to do instead of that mistake.
So the first mistake I see is something called Parkinson's Law. So this guy, last name Parkinson's, did a study in business where he said, if you give someone something to do and tell them to get done Friday by 5, when do they start working on it? And the average time was like Friday at 4:30. So time kind of expanded if there wasn't a plan. So Then he started looking at money, and he looked at Parkinson's Law of money, which was, if you have an increase in income, your expenses will rise to meet or unfortunately exceed that increase because people spend optimism. Entrepreneurs are sometimes the worst at this. They have a good month, next month's only going to be better. So all of a sudden they start over leveraging, they start borrowing, they start increasing expenses, and they haven't really built a plan to pay themselves first. And that's so easy to say, pay yourself first. George S. Clausen wrote a book in the 1920s called Richest Man in Babylon. The main premise of the book is pay yourself first and then live off the rest. His notion was pay 10% to yourself first, which is a simple way to do it. Set up a separate bank account wherever you're currently banking. Every time you make a deposit, have an automatic percentage go to that separate account. That's paying yourself first, and then live off the rest. If you do that and you don't spend more than you make, you don't have to budget. And that's kind of nice, because budgeting can be a mistake for people because they get overly critical about every expenditure. They don't invest enough in themselves. They don't have any joy with their money because they're just accumulating it and they're addicted to holding on to what they've got. So paying yourself first, so having a plan so you don't get in Parkinson's Law and get hurt that way. And then another mistake that people really make is they typically overpay tax, they typically overpay interest, they typically overpay on investment fees that are non-performing, like legal fees, admin fees inside of retirement plans, and they typically have their insurances structured so poorly that they're paying way too much for very little coverage. And so rather than take more risk, the mistake is to take more risk to get return. The reality is lower your and be more efficient with your expenses. It's not about cutting things out. It's about plugging financial leaks. So when people think about living within their means, I mean, what do you think most people think when they hear to live within their means is the action to take?
Drive a 40-year-old car.
Exactly. Cut back, reduce, eliminate. I recommend living in within your means in two other ways. The mistake is to only think about cutting back. The preferred method is to be more efficient. The even more preferred method is to expand your means, which means sometimes investing in yourself, which means considering ways you can add more value, or you could become more valuable with the skill sets that you have, or you're thinking in service in a way that could be profitable for you. And a lot of people don't think that way because they're trading time for money. And then they think, well, there's not enough time to handle my finances. I don't have enough money left over to handle my finances, but simply restructuring loans or reallocating assets that are underperforming to pay off higher interest rate loans can produce more cash flow, or renegotiating interest rates. These are all things that could be extraordinarily useful, but because we're intimidated by finance and we don't think that we have the time, or we have to just rely upon the experts, utilize experts, don't rely upon them. And focus on cash flow instead of accumulation. One of the major faulty notions, and I can break it down in a formula, is that we should accumulate wealth. Accumulation is a term we use accompanied with wealth a lot of times, but accumulation can become damaging. Because accumulation is usually about three things. How much money can you set aside? How much risk are you willing to take? And how long are you willing to wait? In my book, Killing Sacred Cows, I kind of defeat those three myths. It takes money to make money is a myth. It takes value creation. We have other capital other than financial capital. Our mental capital, which is our ideas, knowledge, wisdom, insights, strategies, and tools. And relationship capital, which is people, networks, organizations, mentors, friends, and family. The key is, how do we tap into our mental capital to serve more people, to solve bigger problems. And as a byproduct, money will be will come. And so ultimately, I want people to think about expanding their means, becoming more efficient within their means, paying themselves first. And instead of thinking about accumulation, which is high risk equals high return, is the second notion of that, is plug your financial leaks. Take less risk so you have more sustainability. And then instead of thinking in 30 years, become economically independent as soon as possible. Economic independence is when you have enough recurring revenue, either from assets that create cash flow or entrepreneurial income, which is income that comes in from something you don't have to monitor and manage every single day, but you're still responsible for. Like I have books that I've written 12 years ago that are still paying me money. That's recurring revenue. Now, I took the time to write the book, and that's quite the process. But it's something that creates recurring revenue over time that covers my basic expenses. So every day, if I earn more money, I can build more assets that create more cash flow. And see, most people are trying to save 10% of their income. They're trying to earn 10% on that 10%. My belief is get enough cash flow to cover 100% of your expenses. And then 100% of what you earn can help you build those assets, increase your cash flow, and let that increased cash flow drive your lifestyle rather than increased income that's from active income that you require to show up the next day to keep earning, because people get stuck trading time for money. So I know there's a lot to unpack in there, but accumulation, not paying yourself first, taking too much risk, not being more efficient with your money, and not focusing on investing in yourself are some of the major mistakes. But let me narrow it down to this before the next thing you say. The number one financial mistake, bar none, nothing will ever compete with this, is when people buy into the scarcity myth. Scarcity is born of fear, doubt, and worry. It's a perspective where we look to take more from the world than we give. It's a zero-sum game, compete instead of collaborate, hold on to what you've got, fight for what you have, do things at the expense of others, and scarcity will decimate us, because no amount of luck, no amount of saving, no discipline, no rate of return, or no financial advisor will save someone who's stuck in the scarcity paradigm. Scarcity is the main culprit that destroys wealth. It is the main thing that promotes this mythology that harms people rather than helps them. And when we can embrace a paradigm of being a producer where we add more value in the world than we take, and when we become a steward where we monitor our finances and we're responsible for what comes in, and we look to grow that in an intentional way versus an accidental way or through speculation or through neglect, then life gets better. But it's hard up front. It makes life easier. It's hard to confront our finances, but life gets easier if we do. It's hard to be efficient up front, but then it gets easier once we're more efficient. It's not that hard to pay ourselves first. If we're willing to just do it, life gets easier. So I believe in hard easy versus easy hard. Easy hard is set it, forget it, invest early, often, and always, hope that it works out in 30 years, and we find out it didn't. Hard is I'm going to do the things I need to today to be better with my money, to increase my financial intelligence. And I'll at least make it a little bit easier by being funny here and there instead of always this serious, but you'll always get the passion either way. I always got the passion.
Absolutely, my man. Absolutely. Now, you set aside years of your youth to go and learn from these people, and you just dropped so much information. You know, you've forgotten more than most of us will ever learn. What is the best way to self-educate? And be you know, tell which one of your books we should start with. Don't be afraid of self-promotion. We're not shy of that here.
Well, look, I'll even just gift the books that are most impactful. The two books that are the first book is Killing Sacred Cows, and I'm going to be candid. It doesn't put the pieces together. What Killing Sacred Cows does is help you avoid the missteps. It gives you permission to succeed. And once you know the 9 myths that are very subtle yet dangerous, you'll know how to avoid those landmines. The second book is What Would Billionaires Do? Sometimes also called What Would Rockefellers Do? But the Rockefeller family wanted me to change the title, and I don't want to pick a fight with the Rockefeller family. Yeah. So that book puts very strategic ideas on the ground so you can get started. So the combination of those two books are extraordinarily helpful. Killing Sacred Cows, I've reread many times, and I'm honestly shocked how well it holds up. And I think it's even more valid now than when I wrote it. And I have a new book coming out later called Disrupting Sacred Cows, where I'm taking and updating Sacred Cows and saying, here's the things to watch for in the new economy. But as I read that book, man, It's a little wordy at times. I get criticized for that. But I mean, on Audible, I think it's got 750 listens now. And I think it's like 4.8 stars out of 5. So it's a good book. I am proud of it. I would give it to anyone. And I don't care how intelligent someone is about money, that book has merit. I've had people completely change their paradigm on how to transfer risk from that book. I've had people understand what debt actually is versus, and what it isn't, that actually teach in the financial world. I had someone that works with people that are worth only $100 million or more at one of the major financial institutions say that that book's been the biggest game changer for how he views finance, and that it's impacted how he helps these really wealthy people out, which the book wasn't really written for them, but it applies regardless of if you're starting out as a college student or whether you already have money, because it's a philosophical and methodological, and it brings a philosophical construct, not just a strategic construct, where what would the Rockefellers do, AKA what would billionaires do, gives you more practical advice of what to do.
What the heck would a billionaire do with money?
And by the way, wealthfactory.com/megakit, MEGAKIT. You give your email, you get these things for free type of thing. So that's the exchange. Cool. But what a billionaire would do is, well, one thing is that they start mitigating and managing risk. That's one thing that the billionaires do that others don't. Number two is that they would have a financial team to support them and do real due diligence. And where they start is that they start with ways to be more efficient with their taxes, because they're paying so much in tax, if they don't do anything about it, that it's probably the biggest thing that they could do. And then what they're going to do, and this is interesting, because in Tony Robbins' book, Money Master the Game, he asked all these billionaires what they would do. But the one that I thought was most honest was Mark Farber, the boom, doom, and gloom guy. Oh, yeah. He said, look, if I could only give my kids one piece of advice about money, it would be this. Figure out a skill set that matters. Figure out something that's missing from the world or is in high demand, and build a structure to deliver that to the world, whether that's a business or whether that's in a business that you have upside potential. And billionaires really, you know, the other billionaires in the book are the ones that invented an index fund, but tell people to put money in an index fund. They didn't become billionaires by putting money there. They created something that they give to the world, you know? And so that's the thing is, you know, that you really got to like figure out your investor DNA, which is what are your core values, because that's your script for how to operate. What are your core competencies where you have natural, you know, inclinations and intuition and strategy and knowledge? And then what are your core drivers, the things that you're really excited about? When you combine those three things, what billionaires do is they focus first before they diversify. Everybody else diversifies because they spread themselves thin before they get good enough at something. But when you focus, like Andrew Carnegie said, put all your eggs in one basket and watch it like a hawk. Focus combined with risk management versus diversification being the all-encompassing thing is more of what a billionaire would do. When a billionaire diversifies, it's because they have so much money, they have to strategically allocate it outside of what their original expertise was. But many times they're doing it in a way that's complementary to what they know, and they're acquiring things that they know how to grow versus moving into things they know nothing about.
Got it. Yeah. I mean, that's powerful. And have you read a lot of Keith Cunningham's books, right? Mm.
Keith is amazing. And I think his stuff is very spot on. I remember the first time I spoke when Killing Sacred Cows came out, he was speaking at the same event. It was a mortgage event for this guy, Stephen Marshall. And he's just walking to the back of the room while I'm up on stage. And he's like a preacher. He's like, amen. I like what you're saying there. And he goes, I love your book. Like he was awesome. So we kind of built a relationship a little bit that way. And, you know, I put one of his books in the top five financial books out there. I think he's got amazing stuff. I don't know if it was really a financial book, but it's like his book, what does he call it? BS, getting past the BS of business or straightforward. I can't remember. I read Keys to the Vault years ago, but I can't remember the name of his other book that I liked even more.
Got it. Yeah. The one I'm reading right now is The Road Less Stupid.
That's the one. Less Stupid. Yeah. The Road Less Stupid.
Yeah. I mean, he talks about the stupid tax in there, which I've paid too many times in business. And he just has three questions on helping you through that. So, man, this has been super, super helpful. I want to switch gears a little bit and just ask you, how the heck, you have three kids or two?
Two kids.
Yeah, two kids. Two. So how did you grow your businesses and take care of your family and manage your time and own your time? What were some of the techniques that you used? Because, you know, here at Early to Rise, being the author of the Perfect Day Formula and all that stuff, it's important for our listeners to see other entrepreneurs with families be able to, you know, quote unquote, do it all. What worked for you and what didn't?
I did it really poorly to begin with. When my wife told me she was pregnant with our first son, I didn't even celebrate because I had so many projects going on in business. I just couldn't imagine taking time for anything else. Mm-hmm. One of these big regrets of my life. The good news is I ended up apologizing and taking responsibility later, and my wife forgave me. I asked for what I call a do-over. I said, if I had to do that, to do all over again, I'd do it totally different. And so I was, you know, he was born in 05, and I was just, I had a couple partners. We were launching these new Curriculum for Wealth symposiums. And then my partners died 2 months after my son was born in a plane crash. And I just doubled down on work. I mean, I never saw my son. He was asleep when I left for work in the morning. And by the time I got home late at night, and it wasn't until 4 months after their death that I'm driving to Thanksgiving, which was the first day off. June 9th, they died. My first day off is November 24th. So I worked every day between then. And most days was 12 hours, sometimes 16 hours, which, by the way, is not effective work because I'm exhausted, because I can't make simple decisions, because I'm so tired that I'm not bringing the best of what I have. And we're driving down to visit my family 2 hours. And we haven't even spoken a word halfway through this trip. And my wife is driving because I'm so tired. And she just goes, so I think you're a pretty extraordinary businessman. And I'm like, oh, cool. She's saying that to make me feel better. And initially it did. But then she glances at our son in the back seat, who's one at the time, and turns to me and says, yeah, but you're an ordinary husband and father. That was the moment. I cried. I teared up. I didn't even get defensive because it was so, it hit me so hard. And within 7 days, I told my team I was going to take 30 days at home to focus on my family and self-care. I started to actually sleep. I actually started working out again. Mm-hmm. And it was crazy because life started to get immensely better. I started to get more energy. I actually wrote Killing Sacred Cows during that month because my wife and son would take a nap and I would start writing. I just was renewed. And I just stopped dealing with drama. I stopped answering everyone's questions all the time. I let them grow up. And from there, I really implemented, after my partners died and during that month off, I flew to Toronto and met with Dan Sullivan and Babs Smith. Oh, yeah. And Babs just lectured the hell out of me saying, if you don't take time off, you're done. This isn't going to work. And so I planned out 180 days off that year. I think 170 days off.
Wow.
And spent tons of time with my family, and my income went up just under 200 grand. So 170 days off from the year before being like, maybe I took Christmas off, maybe I took Thanksgiving off. And that's when life started to really change and I got really strategic. I got to the point where I was taking days off on Wednesday. Nobody else of my friends were taking days off. So it was kind of weird days. Sometimes I would read, I would get bored. I found out daytime TV sucks. you know. But then I've gotten really good at this. I mean, I took 2 months off, 63 days off with my family in Italy, the summer of 2018. Or 2017, took a month off the next year. So what I found was when I had relaxation, rejuvenation, and recreation, I came back more powerfully. And then I just started creating big blocks of time to write and big blocks of time to do things that were outside of, you know, one-on-one. And I just started to delegate a whole lot better. I delegated roles, R-O-L-E-S, not tasks, so I could have that space. My business had to change and grow differently if I was going to take that much time off. So it allowed other people to grow. And look, I was kind of in my business partner Les's shadow before he died. I always like deferred to him for intellectual creation. And when he died, I started to step that up. And I realized if I'm not always there, other people grow and step up. So your perfect day formula, you know, I gave that to my wife because I started getting really good at those kind of things. And her schedule kind of would slip all the time and was always dealing with chaos. And I was like, you just need to structure this a little bit better. And so I really recognized the importance of play in my life. I feel like I win when I'm at play. I'm at my cabin. It looks like I'm an alcoholic with all that behind me. But the reality is I've got I shot my bow today at a target. You know, I've got a fishing pond that I'll go to on the weekends. We're on a river here. I like to take walks with my wife. I like to make lattes for everybody in the morning and sit around and have a conversation either before or after the workout. So I've just found some time to really recharge, because I learned that when I was really bad at it at the very first part. Now, I still have moments where I sprint a little bit too much and I have to be reminded to take some time off, you know, especially with a comedy tour coming up. That can happen from time to time, but I just schedule things like date night. I schedule things like family meetings with my kids. I schedule things like guys night out with my kids, you know, so that I'm doing things and not just letting that Parkinson's law take over my calendar.
Comedy tour. Now this, yeah. When you told me about the comedy tour, well, first of all, the American Ream, where does somebody actually download and watch that? Is that available online? Cause I know you sent me a Vimeo link.
No, I sent it to you because we're friends and I wanted to share it with you and ask for your help to kind of, the tour is really the only place to see it right now. The plan with the tour is, as the tour happens, pitch this American Ream that's already recorded and edited to a streaming service that everybody could see. But one of the things we're tinkering with is, you know, after someone comes to the comedy show, allowing them have access to the American Ream that you saw, because I think I'm proud of it. I think it's pretty amazing. I mean, it's surprisingly funny is what my wife says. That was really funny. And she's watched it multiple times. Even my kids watch it.
Yeah. I mean, hey, listen, I told you, as somebody who has filmed a lot of video and doesn't necessarily enjoy it, particularly memorizing scripts and that sort of stuff, what you did at the start of that little intro for everybody listening, you know, Garrett basically does a 3 or 4 minute rap that, you know, a monologue that he memorized, and, you know, there was tongue twisters and, you know, there was probably like, you know, Eminem level of words in that entire thing. And it was so impressive. And I just thought, most of the days I was watching this and going, it was painful for me to watch, because I was not, because it was bad. It's amazing. But for me to think of like how much time and effort and love you put into that. And it's not something that I love doing. So, you know, I hope that you did, because it was amazing. It's absolutely amazing. And so
I'm willing to give people a taste of it right now. If you want, I'd be willing to stand up right now and do it. All right,
let's go.
Let's see. It's been a minute, but I'm pretty sure I worked on that so often. Money, money talks, money walks. Money isn't everything, but they say money makes the world go around. Money can't buy you love, but money matters, because time is money. Money doesn't grow on trees, but it takes money to make money. There's easy money, even money, smart money, dumb money, old money, new money, mad money, funny money. There's loud money, hush money, short money, long money. You could be on the money, in the money, even made of money, because money makes the man. You can throw money at it, throw money around, even throw good money after bad. Money's no object when you're a money machine with money to burn, just pouring money down the drain. But for the love of money, I hope your money grubbing hands get the money's worth. Oh, more money, more problems. Got my mind on my money and my money on my mind. Get your money for nothing and your chicks for free. So show me the money. So that's 3 of the 16 scenes right there. Yeah.
I mean, this was great, but when, you know, you add in the, you know, the sleight of hand, the props and everything is really great. And all the names for money that you had in that one section, absolutely fantastic. And again, like, not only as like an audience member, but as a performer, like, that is absolutely really fantastic. So, you know, kudos to you. And then, so are you going to, when you go on your comedy tour, are you going to put some of that in the show, or is it going to be all new, or what?
So that video will start the show.
Got it.
And then I'll come out on stage after the video. And when I filmed, we did 2 hours and 25 minutes of new content, and we kept 51 minutes in the special just because of the framework of what the streaming services are. So anyone that comes to the show, a couple of things I can promise you. No show will be identical, because my executive producer, who's a genius, is like, when I get on a mistake, I should run with it and let that happy accident occur. So in the special that I sent you, there's 5 straight minutes that is a completely unplanned, that is the funniest part of the special. I went to say the tooth fairy and I said the tooth bunny. So I just go off this riff about the tooth bunny.
Yeah.
I go to say the word Viagra, I slip. And so I talk about the one time I took Viagra in Paris, and I tell this whole story around it. And then, you know, so like I have a lot of content that we didn't put in that video, and we're going to always have a camera crew, because I don't know if we've announced this, but we're going to take everybody that signs up, and then I'm going to bonus them at the end, the best of the actual tour, the stuff that's not in the special, those magical moments that were accidents, and just kind of bonus it. Because I mean, look, Craig, let me be candid. I don't know what COVID's going to bring to us in the middle of this tour, if it cancels dates. But one thing I do know is I've already got 100 contingency plans to add value and humor to people's lives in case one of these dates doesn't happen. And the good news is, I mean, I've got Gotham Comedy Club that's agreed, and I've got a comedy store in La Jolla. Like, we'll just do a different date if we have to, but I'll be giving people bonuses that'll help them with their finances, and bonuses that'll help them with, you know, laughing in the middle of a crazy time, if we have any of those things occur. And we'll just delay it if we have to and come back at a different time, because I want to get this in people's hands now, either way.
Yeah. Yeah. You know, Billy Jean is a famous marketer, you know, and he said something like, if you can learn how to sell with humor, it is the absolute highest level of, you know, online sales and marketing today. And I absolutely agree, because it's one thing, you know, here's another guy with a whiteboard. I ain't going too far in this day and age of every man and woman with a whiteboard out there. But here you are taking something that is complex, it's scary, it's not talked about. And it's like one of the most important things, like money, you know, without money, it's difficult to function and support your family. And everybody listening has probably had a moment of panic around money. And here you are finally explaining it in a way that doesn't make everybody's eyes glaze over and gets the conversation going. So what you're doing is absolutely awesome. So yeah, I think it's very important for everybody to know, like, when's tour start? Where the heck is the tour showing up? We'd love to know that.
Yeah. So we're having all those sites live here that I'll get to you, so they could just go and sign up and register. And they even get to take a quiz and figure out their money personality. So
Nice.
We're just giving them some really cool insights. But I make inflation funny, Wall Street, insurance, taxes, you know, frugal versus cheap is one of my favorite bits that I do. I mean,
this is as good as Jerry Seinfeld making proctology funny.
Man, I got to tell you, I'm just so, you feel my passion for it. I mean, like, I started doing comedy as a hobby in August of 2017, and then kind of got what I would call discovered by someone in August of 2019. And he said, when he shook my hand, he's done 22 specials. He was, he's the one behind Vicious Circle with Dane Cook, and did Whitney Cummings' first special, and, you know, has represented everybody from Bill Burr and Dave Chappelle. And he saw something in me, and he knew this money thing was an angle that's never really been done in comedy. So he saw it, and I got to tell you, I think it turned out really great. And I was spending 8 hours some days just on rehearsal. I mean, you know, just walking the neighborhood with my dog, walking with my team, and just trying to make them laugh and memorizing it. But it was fun. I mean, I was nervous, because I'm like, okay, we've got 8 cameras. We've got Emmy winning people on this crew that have done some of my favorite specials, from Joe Coy to Daniel Tosh to, you know, just some amazing stuff. And am I funny enough? And my wife was very hesitant initially, but then I started making her laugh, and you see her in the crowd a couple of times because she's in some of the jokes, and she was laughing hysterically. And I mean, it's funny, because Marty Kallner was like, I picked to be your executive producer, 'cause I think you're funny. And Carlin was his best man, and he did the first comedy special ever. He did the Steve Martin special. That was the first comedy special ever, and he was part of that. So I feel really honored to have these kind of people in my life and take it to a different level.
Okay. So what's the link again for all the dates and everything?
I have to just send it to you, because I think you have a special link that I created for you.
And it
will be live. It will be live in like 48 hours from the time we're doing this.
Okay. Got it. Perfect. Yeah. So, but what is the first date that you have on the calendar? What dates are people?
September 7th in Tempe, September 7th in Tempe, September 8th in La Jolla, at the La Jolla Comedy Store. So yeah, we have 15 cities, including Boston and New York and DC and Dallas and Chicago and Austin. And
are you taking a break during that, or are you just doing?
Yeah, I have two times I'm coming home for vacation, and then 1 week I might do two cities and then come home for a week.
Got it.
So yeah, I'm bringing my family on some of it. I'm going to have my son open for some of the places because he did so good the night that we did it. I've even got some friends that have been speakers for years. They're going to do some opens that are pretty well-known people that are funny, but they've never done stand-up. Some have done a little bit of stand-up. So it's going to be unique each city. I think it's going to be a lot of fun. And then five of the cities, we're doing two-day workshops to help people get their money dialed in. Yep. So that'll be cool too.
Awesome, man. Well, Garrett, this has been really, really fantastic. What is the link again? Let's go to the Mega Kit link again for people to get the books. So that's wealthfactory.com/MegaKit.
Yep. MEGA, Mega Kit.
Yeah. Okay. Awesome. So everybody listening, start with his books there, and then you'll get the information on his tour. And if you're in any of those cities, if you live in America and you get a chance to go, you know, take your friends, take your family, because they've never heard money explained like this before. They've never been introduced to money in this way before by a guy with a passion for your money. He doesn't just have passion for his own money. He has passion for helping everybody with money. So Garrett, I really appreciate the time. Laughed more on this one than most shows. So you're a rock and roll star, my man.
I told you this guy was passionate. I told you he was funny. And so if you do love comedy, make sure you try and get out to one of Garrett's shows in the United States. If you're there, make sure that you go to wealthfactory.com/megakit to get his free books. Change your mindset about the myths about money so that you take back control of your financial future. There's still time, and I really want the best for you. And so does Garrett. That's, you can tell by the passion in his voice. And his story was incredible. His examples were incredible. His advice was excellent. And I can't wait for you to change your money situation. All right. So my friend, can't wait to speak with you again on another episode of Early to Rise Radio. If you have any questions, make sure to head over to iTunes and give us that 5-star review and rating, and drop me the questions on Instagram at Real Craig Valentine. And we'll be back very soon.